In the coming week, the World Health Summit 2020 takes place. Chileans vote in a constitutional referendum amid protests, and Tanzania holds a general election. It's October 22nd, 2020, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Well, Jim, in the coming week, the World Health Summit 2020 takes place virtually, given our world health crisis that we're dealing with. It has historically taken place in Berlin, and the coronavirus is keeping everyone in their respective offices and home studies and so forth. So, Jim, tell us this year about the summit, though. What should we know about the main issues on the agenda?
Well, Bob, let's begin with a little bit of background. The World Health Summit is scheduled to take place every October in Berlin. It was started back in 2009 on the 300th anniversary of Berlin Charité Hospital. Now, if that name sounds familiar, that's the hospital where Alexei Navalny went for treatment after being poisoned when he was in Siberia. So it's a major hospital. And this summit has been organized originally under the auspices of the German Chancellor and the French President. It's since been expanded to include the President of the European Commission and the Director General of the World Health Organization. And the summit's general purpose is to set the agenda for a healthier future. Now, as you mentioned, the meeting is online this year for obvious reasons, but I should note that not only is it online for the speakers and the normal participants, but apparently anybody who wants to tune into the World Health Summit can do so. Just Google the World Health Summit and follow the relevant directions. You know, this is a big summit. It's supposed to have 300 speakers over several days, and they have 17 major issues that they're going to discuss. And like any conference, it's broken down, you know, each day, each time. There are several sessions going on, but this is a conference taking place in the midst of a surge in the coronavirus around the world. And I think it's safe to say that the pandemic and its consequences are going to dominate the conversation. The conference is taking place amidst the surge in the virus around the world. And this looks to be the widely predicted second wave is manifesting itself. And I note that as we're taping this right now, the country of Ireland has become the first country in Europe to impose a second national lockdown as cases of coronavirus surge. The Czech Republic looks like it is also heading toward a national lockdown. Britain, France, Germany, and Spain have set regional restrictions this month. Indeed, as I understand it, if you're a resident of Madrid, Spain, you can't leave the city for non-essential reasons. That's how tight the lockdowns have been. So, and again, this is sort of sparking a lot of talk about how effective are lockdowns, how long they have to be carried out, whether you can have targeted lockdowns versus broad lockdowns. And of course, the real question of the fact that a lot of people don't like being locked down, that in essence, people have grown tired of having to change your lifestyle because of the coronavirus. And of course, the counter argument, which is, you know, people may be tired of the coronavirus, but the coronavirus isn't tired of them. Obviously, a lot of discussion about vaccines. When might they be ready? How effective will they be? Who will get them? Who will pay for them? And I don't, on that front, we've seen recently here in the United States where a number of vaccines are in so-called phase three trials. I think it's Johnson & Johnson and Eli Lilly both had to halt their trials because they got some results that were disturbing. Meanwhile, China's been moving ahead very aggressively with vaccines. I think there's a state-owned company in China that is offering them, and let me put offering in air quotes, it's not clear to what extent this is voluntary, offering vaccines to students going abroad. And the Chinese have moved very quickly to distribute the vaccine to many of its citizens. Again, it's not clear how effective that vaccine is. It's not clear how safe it is. And I know there's been a lot of talk, certainly in Western scientific circles, that the Chinese have been moving far too quickly. Just one last thing, obviously, is I think one of the big questions that's going to come up at the conference is about so-called vaccine diplomacy. You know, obviously, for a country like the United States, think Western Europe, even the Chinese, you know, highly developed countries, at least in a technological sense, can be able to produce vaccines for their citizens. But as you know, for most countries around the world, lack that medical technical infrastructure to design their own vaccines or the wealth to be able to pay a premium price on the international market for a vaccine. So who gets access to vaccines? And the Chinese have been very sort of forward-leaning recently about their willingness to distribute hundreds of millions, if not billions of doses of a vaccine to countries. And this is widely seen as an effort by the Chinese, not just to help arrest a global health crisis that the failures of the Chinese government help trigger, but also to try to burnish China's soft power and to sort of take a bit of the edge off reactions around the world to China's rather aggressive foreign policy in other arenas.
So, Jim, you've laid out a lot of issues, a lot of major issues that seem to make this World Health Summit super relevant this October. But I'm wondering, as you reference things like vaccine nationalism and some of the disagreements about the merits of lockdowns and other policies, to what extent do we know that there's any kind of global conversation going on about, at this stage, 7, 8, 9 months into the pandemic, whether there is some sort of a regular conversation? And when I say conversation, I mean maybe it's among health ministers, or maybe it's among crisis managers in major countries or whatever, or whether it is still this sort of the big countries reserve the right to do what they feel like, and we'll share information when we feel like it.
Well, Bob, during the COVID crisis, the operative word has been nationalism, not multilateralism. And I think that's in part because the country that typically sort of rallies up the community to act is the United States. And we currently have a president who doesn't see that as the role of the United States. He sees the world as a place where individual countries should pursue their own national interests. So, for example, there is this global effort called COVAX, which is to bring countries together on the front of developing and distributing vaccines. The United States is not a party to COVAX. I should note that the Chinese were actually relatively late in joining COVAX. They only did so, I guess about 2 weeks ago now in doing so. So there's been a lot more focus on countries sort of looking inward and not working jointly, which I think is somewhat hobbled the global response.
And obviously the WHO is a kind of a tarnished brand as well in some sectors.
Certainly. And again, I'm always reminded by people who think there's value for the United States in being in the WHO, that one, the WHO can only do as much as its member countries want it to do. And in this case, China hobbled the WHO coming out of the gate. But the second thing is that the WHO is actually a relatively small organization. And indeed, if you look at it, take a major hospital in New York City, its budget is larger than the budget of the WHO. So we shouldn't exaggerate what it is that the WHO can or should be expected to do. But again, we're sort of seeing a lack of coordinated responses. And I think that has exacerbated the problem. And the reality is, and again, I'll refer to the newly released Council Independent Task Force report on preparing for the next pandemic, we are likely to see more diseases, novel diseases popping up in the future. This current crisis has really rocked the globe. But if you've looked back over the past 30 years or so, a number of other viruses have come up. It's quite possible in the future we will not only see another new virus, but one that could potentially be even more devastating than COVID-19 has proven to be so far.
It's a good point. And I think one of the things that the CFR Task Force and other sort of major studies of this pandemic and others note is that, well, it's not only a matter of, say, altruism for the U.S. to bolster an international effort as well as a vaccine distribution plan against an existing pandemic, but it's also self-interest, whether it's the current pandemic and making sure that there are not corners of the world in which it can spark up again and soon enough spread, but also to cut them off at the pass, to build good practices, and at the end of the day to protect the homeland as well.
Yeah, no, it is a problem that is going to continue, Bob, because as you point out, being good for a month or 2 months in terms of public health prevention measures only helps you for those 2 months or so. If you relax your guard, if you let your guard down, the virus can come roaring back. And we're seeing that happen again in Europe. We're seeing it happen in the United States. We're seeing it happen in a number of other countries. And so this is a very big and very tough public health challenge, but also a governance challenge in terms of how do you get people to continue to take the steps needed to blunt the transmission of the virus when we don't have an effective vaccine, may not have an effective vaccine for months or even longer. Because again, it's one thing to announce that a vaccine has passed safety and efficacy protocols. It's another thing to actually manufacture it, produce it, and then distribute it. And that raises a whole other set of issues. So this is going to be with us for quite a while. And I think people who thought that COVID-19 would, sort of pass by the end of the summer and we could move on and we could put it behind us, we're wrong. And in fact, we're going to be dealing with COVID-19 and its consequences for quite some time. Bob, let's change gears and topics and talk a little bit about politics and elections. I want to talk about a constitutional referendum that is set to go to the voters this weekend in Chile. The vote, which was originally scheduled to take place last April, but was postponed because of COVID-19, has been making headlines since pro-constitutional reform protesters took to the streets about a year ago. So Bob, bring us up to speed about what the dispute is about in Chile and how this is likely to play out.
Well, as you mentioned, Jim, the protesters took to the streets about a year ago, initially triggered by a 4-cent rise in metro fees. And it was, enormously symbolic increase because it triggered all sorts of standard of living debates and really visceral protests about inequalities in Chile, which, as we have discussed before, as has been written in many places, has for long been seen as the poster child of democratic reform, of a high growth economy in a part of the world where there's still sort of laggard growth. And yet there was very much brought to the surface this concern about inequality. And I think also it surfaced a real deep discontent with the fact that the country was still operating under the 1980 constitution that was written under dictator Augusto Pinochet. So what they are supposed to do in this referendum is it asks the voters two questions. Should Chile convene a constitutional convention to write a new constitution? If so, who should write that constitution? An assembly of half congressional representatives and half citizens, or an assembly comprising just citizens? So that kicks off a process. And by the way, that's supposed to, by all indications, the voters will vote for a new constitution written by their fellow citizens. And then that process plays out over more than a year before a constitution is then sort of set in place and approved and formally approved by Chileans. So the country is having a reckoning, as so many countries are in the world, Jim. In this case, it's a country that has been enjoying an arc of, let's just say, broad prosperity, or if you look at big numbers, it seems to be advancing. Certainly, a number of people lifted out of poverty and sort of the strengthening of democratic institutions. And yet this deep concern that the Constitution as it exists does not allow for governments to expand things like social welfare. It was very much of a constitution written to preserve certain prerogatives, let's say, of free market parts of the economy. It was inspired and guided by what's known as, I think, the Chicago School of Economists, very much free market guided. And yet there's been a number of people in Chile and outside Chile saying it has a sense of limiting the country. And there's also a school of people both inside the country now who say, while there's a yearning for this, this move in and of itself, it's not going to be a silver bullet for the country's problems.
Now, Bob, as you sort of relay what's happening in Chile, I kept thinking about how what's happening in Chile is really representative of what's happening in countries across the globe. You know, it ties back to what we were just talking about with COVID-19. That is, over the past several decades, global growth went up. Talk about macro statistics, trade is up, incomes are up. We even had good news, number of people living below the poverty line globally had fallen sharply. But even among all of those good numbers and that good news, it was clear there was growing inequality within countries, and it's not just Chile. You can see it in the United States, where income inequality is at levels we haven't seen since the 1920s. And then on top of it, you have COVID-19, which has very clearly hurt countries. And it is, I mean, just take the United States, where you can see that the bottom quartile of the American population has been particularly hard hit. Working class people, people who work in bars and work at airports, restaurants, with those things closing down, have been really hurt. We're seeing it globally. And I think this is going to be one of the big issues going forward, which is, what steps do you take that can address that inequality, and what steps actually work in reducing that inequality? And my sense is that there are deep disputes on the answers to both questions.
No, it's a really good point, Jim. And it's an area where democracies, no matter how strong and how advanced, are, let's say, on the one hand, very vulnerable to disruption and to upheaval because of their very nature and the fact that people are recognizing what's happened, because democracies can also be distorted, and free market democracies have been. And so you're absolutely right. Chile is part and parcel of a whole number of cases playing out worldwide. You'll see variations and you'll see intensifying debates debates about social safety nets in various countries, especially the United States, that will continue to play out. I mean, we're talking now as there's still an effort in the U.S. Congress to try to eke out another stimulus package, which at the end of the day is a big government outlay to try to ease the burdens on a huge chunk of the population. It seems to have some sort of big outlay, seems to have the support of President Trump and congressional Democrats, but not Senate Republicans. And so that's a knife edge issue for this country as well. We'll see how Chile handles this weekend. I mean, in the run-up to it, there was a resurgence of the protests and again, really angry kind of actions, property destruction, clashes, police and protesters and so forth, that are showing the kind of raw emotions that are involved in this issue. The issue of the combination of long festering inequalities or growing inequalities tipped off and ticked off by the coronavirus. But again, this upheaval emerged 4 or 5 months before the coronavirus pandemic hit, and it was touching on something that was actually playing out around the rest of the world. Last year, we did on our website, CFR.org, a narrative slideshow of what we called the year in protest. 2019 was known as the year in protest, and they were everywhere. We just talked about Bolivia on this podcast, a whole set of other issues playing out there. That was a backlash against what we're seeing as some socialist abuses. So,
well, we could add to that Belarus. We can talk about Kyrgyzstan. Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of countries.
We're going to talk some more about elections on this podcast. So I think, again, there's this super reckoning going on, and let's see if democracies are going to be, you know, resilient enough to deal with it. So, Jim, I want to keep us on the topic of votes, and we're going to go over to Africa, the nation of Tanzania, where incumbent President John Magufuli was elected in 2015 with a promise of nationalizing the mining sector, increasing infrastructure projects throughout the country, and thereby lifting the country's welfare. He's facing pushback. Tanzanians are claiming that he has been too quick to silence critics and opponents ahead of the election. So, Jim, can you tell us what are the big things we need to know about this election?
Well, the big thing I think you need to know about the election in Tanzania, Bob, is you are seeing a long dominant political party being challenged and fighting to maintain its dominance. Magufuli's governing party, the Chama cha Mapinduzi, or the CCM for short, has been in power in Tanzania since the country gained independence back in 1961. Now, Tanzania has never been a full democracy in the Western sense of the word, but it has been moving in the right direction. Back in 1992, for example, Tanzania began to have multi-party elections. Tanzania is a country that has avoided the kinds of civil war, military coups, deep suppression of human rights that have plagued many other African countries. However, it remains one of the poorest countries in the world, even though in recent years it's experienced some pretty significant growth rates, 4, 5, 6%. So Tanzania on the economic front is a mix of both good news and some sobering news. But the thing here, and you tipped it off in your question, is that the CCM doesn't want to let go of power. Tanzania's government has imposed restrictions on opposition parties, on human rights groups, on NGOs ahead of the elections. The country has a National Election Commission, and it has found a way to disqualify opposition candidates in past elections. And of course, if you're the dominant party and for one reason or another, your opponents can't run, that kind of eases your way into maintaining power. And I'll note that one of the opponents of Magufuli in this election had his campaign suspended for 1 week by the National Election Commission on the grounds that the candidate had used seditious language and had broken election rules. Now, there have been a lot of criticism of this behavior by the government in Tanzania, a lot of human rights groups arguing that the government is really trying to suppress the opposition. I'll note that Amnesty International has accused Magufuli of weaponizing election laws to stifle all forms of dissent. And, you know, Amnesty International, others point to the fact that local NGOs are banned from observing the elections. Again, for most elections, it's pretty traditional to have outside groups come in and, you know, act as watchdogs and observe and report. Tanzania has basically...
Well, I was going to ask on that front, Jim, do we know whether there's any of these Pan-African organizations, I'm thinking particularly the African Union, having any sort of observer presence or at least keeping an eye on it? They've been trying to step up their oversight of elections in kind of troubled places in recent years, although they obviously have their hands full these days.
I believe so, Bob. But even if it is the case that you have outside observers, if the government has already prevented the opposition from running a free and fair campaign, It's, you know, well on its way to victory even before a ballot is cast. So this is, again, you have to think of elections not just as what happens on election day, but to embed election day in that broader context of all of the things that sort of constrain how people can exercise their rights. I will note that a number of U.S. officials on both sides of the political aisle have warned Tanzania about rigged elections. And those include Jim Risch, who I believe is the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. So we'll see how this goes. Again, the positive aspect of Tanzania is that we haven't seen the kind of violence we've seen in a number of other African countries that has been of great concern. And I should note, in the positive sense for the ruling party in Magufuli, they would argue that, hey, the economy's doing reasonably well, that the president had made good at least some of his pledges back in 2015 to invest more in infrastructure, and that they have a positive message to bring to the people of Tanzania. But again, it's pretty clear that the ruling party, the CCM in Tanzania, very squarely has its thumb on the electoral scale.
As you say, though, it's interesting to keep that in context. We're not talking, after all, about a Zimbabwe-type situation.
Right.
However, in the event we see the incumbent sort of solidly reelected under, say, sketchy circumstances, what he then does, again, thinking about a Zimbabwe case, against any opponents, if he feels more empowered to act against them, that's going to be concerning, obviously.
Fair point, Bob. Let's pivot to our figure of the week portion of the podcast. We're going to start with our audience figure of the week. Remind everybody, you can vote on or tweet us at cfr.org about the audience figure of the week. Bob, we were just talking about Africa. It seems that the audience wants us to stay in Africa. Our audience selected the Lagos 24-hour curfew as their figure of the week. Tell us why.
Well, Jim, I think our audience was hip to a major and what seems to be escalating protest in Africa's most populous country, Nigeria, and also in Nigeria's most populous city, Lagos. We've had a couple of weeks of protests against a government undercover police arm known by the acronym SARS, S-A-R-S.
And that's distinct from the virus by the same name.
That is distinct from the virus, although Nigerians would say it has had a corrosive effect on the country for decades now. President Muhammadu Buhari disbanded the SARS group, but protests continued. And we had in the last couple of days disturbing escalation that indicates that this is obviously bigger than just a single police force, but a broader issue of government response to protests of official corruption, you name it. The big, I think, tipping event this past week, Jim, was a peaceful protest was taking place in one of Lagos's districts near a toll plaza, I believe. And then uniformed armed groups arrived on the scene and in short order started firing on the protesters. As many as 10 people were killed. Dozens were injured. It has sparked outrage locally, internationally. President Buhari, at last I saw, had not commented on that incident. He's been appealing for calm in the country. But Nigeria, given its deep-seated problems with corruption, given its serious problems economically in dealing with an ongoing Boko Haram insurgency in parts of the country, there's a stew of issues going on here, Jim, that feed into our general theme of protests we've been talking about in this podcast, but of a very different sort. So I think people are very concerned about where this could lead in terms of destabilizing this very large, very important country in Western Africa.
Well, I should note on this score, Bob, that people who are interested in following Nigeria more closely should track the work of our colleague John Campbell, who writes a blog at cfr.org about Africa and was formerly the U.S. ambassador to Nigeria. He knows a great deal about the country, indeed has a book coming out in a couple of months on Nigeria, which looks at the very deep divisions that Nigeria has. And, you know, obviously one of the big issues in Nigeria has been the inability of the central government to provide security for the people of Nigeria. We've talked in the podcast before about Boko Haram and other issues. But again, here you have operations in which it appears the central government doesn't control.
Yeah, and it's a good point. John's been blogging all week, by the way, on his Africa in Transition blog, and really a crucial source of information. He's very knowledgeable and authoritative about what has been taking place in the country. I think the problem here, as we've discussed, is it is a large, growing country. There's inequality there, certainly. And there's also this problem of you have, in certain areas, in a place like Lagos, high crime. So you had the initial impetus for creating a special force was to try to tamp down a legitimate problem of crime, just like moves to step up a reaction to Boko Haram require sort of a bulking up of official forces. But they are there have been serial abuses of that. And sometimes the abuses involve brutality against civilians. Sometimes it's just plain old corruption. But it is at such a level, I think, that it's raising a great deal of concern. And again, this latest series of protests and then the latest violence, which was, by the way, captured on video and it's still unclear. Nobody, to the extent I've been following some of the reports on this, no one has been able to actually identify who were the people doing the shooting other than that they were armed and wearing uniforms.
And I should note that it's worth paying attention to what happens in Nigeria because it is the most populous country in Africa. It has something on the order of 200 million people, and that population is continuing to grow. And Nigeria is actually also caught in a difficult spot right now because traditionally oil was a big source of revenue for Nigeria. Often that wealth was siphoned off by corrupt individuals, but the price of oil has fallen in part because of the pandemic and the drop in demand, but for other reasons as well. So the Nigerian economy is under intense pressure, which no doubt is sort of playing into what we're witnessing these days.
Yeah, and just a final note on that. You know, the experts have been saying for years the country has to diversify more from its reliance on these oil revenues. And to be fair, Nigeria is, in a lot of ways, a very dynamic country, very strong entrepreneurial class, one of the major film industries in Africa. And you often hear about this energy that sort of pulses from the country, its music scene and so forth. And a lot of Nigerian athletes are sort of world-class athletes, and whether it's U.S. basketball courts or European soccer leagues or whatever. And yet, there remains this sort of problem and this dependency. And so we'll look for better times for Nigeria, but it's looking pretty tense right now.
Well, I mean, it's a general point. It's very hard to tap into a country's entrepreneurial spirit if the government can't provide rule of law, if corruption is rampant, if there isn't security. And I think that's part of the problem in Nigeria. It doesn't have the kind of good governance a country needs to be able to realize the kind of potential that Nigeria has.
And as always, we thank our audience for helping us walk through a figure of the week. But Jim, how about you? Who or what is your figure?
Bob, my figure of the week is a number, and it's a number that's going to keep me in Africa. The number is 335 million. That's the amount that Sudan has agreed to pay in restitution to the families of U.S. victims of terrorist attacks that targeted the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania back in 1998 and the USS Cole 2 years later. Sudan at that time had hosted al-Qaeda-linked militants and as a result was put on a variety of sanctions and terrorist lists by the United States. And in a deal worked out with the Trump administration, Sudan has agreed to pay American families restitution. We're told that those funds have already been transferred out of the country. And the expectation now for this diplomacy between Khartoum and Washington is that Sudan is going to normalize relations with Israel. Now, I should point out it is unclear when that might happen. Sudan's government is a bit shaky. You may recall that back in April of 2019, the military forced out the long-ruling President Omar al-Bashir, and we now have this sort of transitional government, which is in place. And we should note that there's a hope that Sudan may be able to go down the democratic road, put down democratic roots. But there's always a challenge here that in Sudan, the notion of having relations with Israel is problematic for many individual Sudanese. And so Sudan's civil leadership may want to postpone recognizing Israel. The hope of the Trump administration is that the events of this week are going to provide additional momentum to the Abraham Accords. And again, the theory of the case that the Trump administration has can be summed up as the outside-in theory. The argument was trying to find peace in the Middle East had always been based on trying to find a deal between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And the better way to go about getting peace is to settle the issues between between Israel and many of its Arab neighbors, and then you can put pressure on the Palestinians to make a peace with Israel. We'll see if that actually will take place. I will note that one of the things we're sort of seeing as the sort of Abraham Accords unfold is something that has been long rumored and many people suspected, which is that a number of the Arab governments had sub rosa relations or communications with Israel and have had for a number of years. There's recent reporting that there are front companies in Bahrain that really sort of function as a conduit between the government of Bahrain and the government in Israel. So Middle East politics has always been slightly complex in what you can see on the surface may not tell you what's happening beneath the surface. But obviously that diplomatic process is moving ahead, but we will see if it produces the ultimate payoff down the road.
Yeah, it certainly is a stunning potential set of developments, although there is quite a contrast between, say, a wealthy sort of monarch-controlled Gulf Arab state recognizing Israel and a poor transitional administration that's forking over $300 million and then turning and recognizing Israel. You know, is the pace of change, such change, too fast for a country like Sudan? Not that it shouldn't be happening, but just the pace of it happening. So that's going to be really interesting to see.
What about you, Bob? What is your figure of the week?
Jim, my figure of the week is Pope Francis. Pope Francis this week, maybe going into the week, he didn't realize how widely he'd be followed and tracked for his comments, but comments that came out of a documentary film about the Pope that was launched in the middle of the week about his views on accepting LGBTQ families in Catholic communities. And I want to read the quote that has gotten a lot of attention. In the documentary, he said, "They're children of God and have a right to a family. Nobody should be thrown out or made miserable because of it." Now, on the one hand, it seems like a very kind of modest step, certainly in the countries in which gay marriage has been legalized and gay rights are expanding quite dramatically. But for the Vatican in particular, it's a big step to have a pope saying this even at this time. I mean, you still had, say, 15 to 17 years ago or so, there were Vatican statements about homosexuality being a disordered state of being and not recognizing even civil unions. Now, the pope, it should be noted, as pope and previously as Archbishop of Buenos Aires, has spoken before about civil unions, but he has never come out and said marriage would be blessed in the Catholic Church, marriage of same-sex couples. He said that's something that's inalterable. It's part of the sort of traditional formation of a family. So it's not like this is something that's going to come up for sort of the altering of a church sacrament of marriage. However, it has all sorts of implications for other areas where the church is involved in support for families. The Catholic Church has huge social welfare networks around the world. You know, it could have, you know, implications for decisions in which it offers health care to same-sex partners or adoption or foster programs for same-sex couples and so forth. It's a very interesting set of developments. It's going to raise a whole bunch of debate within the church and without. It just further adds to this Pope's, I think, reputation for going in areas where the church has not been willing to go before.
Are we hearing any dissenting voices in the church, Bob, on this news about where Pope Francis stands? Because obviously there are divisions in the Catholic Church on a number of issues. Pope Francis was seen as being more liberal-leaning than his predecessor in the Holy See. Any early reactions that lets us know whether this is going to be a bigger issue or something that is going to represent unchallenged church doctrine?
You know, I think it's to be expected. I'm not aware of any, but I think it will not be surprising to see that, whether it's coming from conservative cardinals in the church or other sectors. There has already, as you say, been a lot of backlash against what the popes are seen as the pope's more liberal-leaning discussions and so forth. Again, he is not asking for change in doctrine, but by coming out and very clearly endorsing civil unions between same-sex couples, this brings the church in a new territory that a lot of people are not ready to be in. So, as I said, it will generate a great deal of discussion in the church and dissension. So stay tuned on the Vatican front. And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Lebanon and Israel continue U.S.-mediated talks aimed at ending a long-running dispute on their maritime border. And U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo hosts separate talks in Washington with the foreign ministers of Azerbaijan and Armenia, whose countries are at war over Nagorno-Karabakh.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not a CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick. Special thanks go out to Anna Shortridge, Kara Jackson, and Kendall Ross for their assistance. This week, our recording engineer was Zoe Collis. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay safe out there.